it gave me hope and made me feel like, wait a minute, like if this is just insulin resistance of the brain, like I might be able to help my mom. Like that is the biggest relief. I mean, we've never heard of even having any hope of Alzheimer's. It's felt like just like a death diagnosis.
Welcome to the Hairy Chin Podcast, where women are heard, myths are busted, and experts bring real talk. I'm Spencer Moore, your host, and together we're taking back control of female health. Life takes a village. Let's do this together. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Spencer. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so today is a really interesting topic. Today we're talking about insulin resistance, and you are a wealth of knowledge about insulin resistance. I love following your content. You have an amazing Instagram page, and you have a lot of experience with this in your own life and your family's life. So I'm really looking forward to kind of diving deep into the world of insulin resistance and all that goes with it. I'd love to start with an introduction of Denise. So Denise Tuller is a former high school math teacher turned stay-at-home mom and a passionate advocate for metabolic health. A graduate of Brigham Young University, Idaho, she majored in math and minored in health. Now a mother of three daughters, Denise is dedicated to helping families build healthier, more vibrant lives. Her journey into metabolic health began as a personal quest to heal her own body, struggling with constant fatigue, inflammation, prediabetes, insulin resistance, and hormonal imbalances. She realized she needed to take control of her health. Her passion deepened when her mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, a moment that revealed the profound connection between metabolic health and chronic diseases. Inspired by her personal transformation, Denise made it her mission to educate and empower others to prevent and reverse the damage caused by insulin resistance. As a business owner and health advocate, she teaches individuals and families how to reclaim their health through science-backed strategies and targeted support. Driven by her own experiences and a desire to save lives, Denise is committed to helping others heal from the inside out and create lasting change in their health and well-being. That's fantastic. Welcome.
Thanks.
Okay, so like I do in all of my episodes, I start with some statistics. So I would love to talk a little bit about some statistics that really blew my mind. So we're talking about insulin resistance, and with that, we are talking about sugar, more or less. On average, Americans consume nearly 80 pounds of sugar annually. So that is 99 grams per day. Now, to understand that, there's 40 grams of sugar in a 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola. So it's really, if you have two Cokes, you're pretty much there. And look, that's 36,000 grams per person per year. Now, research states that an estimated 60 to 70 million individuals in the United States are affected by insulin resistance, which is a precursor to diabetes. Now, if we go further, because we're going to talk about insulin resistance, and we're also going to talk about what it can do to the female body, what it can cause, right? Because there's just a litany of diseases that insulin resistance can cause. So PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is 50 to 70% of women with PCOS have some degree of insulin resistance. Now, what really blew my mind is that there are correlations now between insulin resistance and Alzheimer's, which is a severe form of dementia. And we will talk about this later because you have personal experience with this. Now, around twice as many women have Alzheimer's than men, which I did not realize that Alzheimer's was a female-led disease. So about 1 in 9 people over 65 are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which is about 10% of the population. And this is what really blew my mind. In a June 2024 article in the UK, dementia is the leading cause of death for women. And this has been the case since 2011. So for me, these statistics really just blew my mind that, I mean, look, I knew insulin resistance was about sugar and diabetes and things like that, but I did not realize how far-reaching insulin resistance is in terms of the whole body.
Yeah, so first and foremost, I'm not a medical professional. Yes. Like stated, I'm a stay-at-home mom who turned very passionate about becoming a metabolic health advocate for my own reasons, which I'm sure we'll get more into. Dr. Robert Lustig is one of my most favorite metabolic health professionals to learn from. And he actually dives really deep into this. And the statistics that you shared about, I believe you said it was like 90 grams of sugar is like the average that we are consuming. Mm-hmm. Now that's the average that we're consuming, but the amount that is recommended and the maximum that our liver can handle is about 25% of that. Now it's different according to where you are at with your metabolism, how efficient your body is at using the nutrients that you give it. But Dr. Robert Lustig, he recommends 20 grams at most of sugar a day. And for kids, it's much, much less. So as Wow. we get younger and younger, like a baby under the age of 2 should be consuming zero amounts of added sugar to their diet. And in elementary years, it's something around, I think it's 12 grams for the entire day. Wow. And so if one Coke is like 30 grams at least, then I mean, they're drinking a third of that, and then that's the most. So that means, I mean, no bananas, no apples, no anything else that even has this good natural sugar.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that the diet of it's just worldwide. I mean, I know that America gets a really bad rap for its diet. And, you know, I live in Europe and a lot of people say, oh, you're so lucky to live in Europe because the diet's so much better there. I mean, there's still tons of sugar here, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of it also is education of learning about what is right for your body, for the individual, and understanding that, you know, if you just go and shop at the grocery store and you pick everything off the aisle, it's not good for you. I mean, you have to get some base form of just dietary education to understand what you need to be putting in your body.
Yeah, for sure. Because we've come to villainize sugar so much.
Mm-hmm.
And like kind of as we get here into some of the science of it, is that it's actually what it does to our blood sugar. So we can consume like pasta, or we can consume like cotton candy, and it's both, they're both going to spike our blood sugar, but we've villainized sugar so much to make ourselves believe, well, I mean, some pasta, it's great for us. Like it's going to be more nourishing, but it's going to do a very similar thing to our blood sugar, which ultimately is making us sick.
Right. It's so interesting. There's an account that I follow on Instagram, and there's a man who has a blood sugar monitor on his arm, and he eats different things, and then he shows the graphs of what happens to his blood sugar. And one of the things that blew my mind of one of the ways that he did it is he ate his food in a different order on his plate a few different times. He had the same meal and he ate it in a different order. And when he had, I believe it was a protein, a vegetable, and a starch. So he started with the vegetable, then he had the protein, then he had the starch. And his blood sugar didn't really rise so much. But when he did the opposite, and he started with the starch, and then the vegetable, and then the protein, his blood sugar had a huge spike. So, I mean, yeah. I don't want to overwhelm the audience of saying, like, look, you have to eat your food in a certain order, and you have to manage all this sugar. It can get a very slippery slope of being very overwhelmed. But I do think that sometimes education is so powerful, and to think that when you sit down and you think you have this, well, you do, you have a healthy plate of a vegetable, a starch, you know, and a protein, maybe the order you eat it might help a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Even if it's just the majority of your time, you're eating your vegetable, your protein, and then your starch. And from time to time, you mix them all together and you eat them together.
But that's right. You have casserole because you're tired.
More, exactly.
Right? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. But I do. I think there's this obsession. I think you're right. Sugar has been so villainized. And, you know, you talk about 20 grams of sugar. I mean, that's basically like a low-carb diet, right? I think that the low-carb diets recommend around 20 grams as the maximum of sugar. A lot of people really love those diets. A lot of people feel really good on those diets, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So explain a bit about what is insulin resistance, because, you know, there's a lot of different things. There's insulin resistance, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And, you know, just for anybody that doesn't maybe understand, there's also type 1 diabetes. Could you kind of walk through the progression and kind of what all those are?
Yeah, for sure. So insulin resistance is something that happens. So I'm going to kind of go way back to the basics. Every single time we eat, When we eat, our body converts whatever we've eaten into glucose. And glucose is our body's preferred nutrient source. So every single cell in our body needs glucose in order to properly function. So, like if we need our nose to smell, our nose cells need glucose. For our tongue to taste, our tongue cells need glucose. For our fingertips to feel, those cells need glucose. So the problem is that when we eat, it's not that our body just converts it to glucose and then it automatically quickly just distributes to all of the cells and we get glucose magically. It actually doesn't happen. In order to get glucose into the cells, our pancreas, it produces a hormone called insulin. And I like to think of insulin as like the key that unlocks the cell. And insulin, when it's produced, it goes over to the cell, it unlocks it, and then it lets glucose in. Well, when we start becoming insulin resistant, it means that those cells that are insulin resistant are not responding to insulin. It's like they can't hear them. It's kind of, I kind of like to think of it as like a mom with one kid is going to be very sensitive to their child's cry, right? Like a small whimper, and they're gonna be like, what's going on? A mom with 10 children is going to be like, ah, they're fine. Like she probably can't even hear a scream. It's like, nah. So our cells start becoming resistant when we have too much insulin in our bloodstream. So then what happens is that it starts creating a plethora of problems. Now, we cannot control what cells become insulin resistant first. But as they start becoming insulin, and nobody has like the same order of insulin resistance. Like we don't say like, oh, your eyes become insulin resistant first, and so you have a hard time seeing, or hey, your liver becomes insulin resistant first. So we don't control what becomes insulin resistant first. But there is a spectrum of insulin resistance. And when we start becoming more and more insulin resistant, if it goes too far, it becomes prediabetes. And if it goes even further and even more cells are becoming insulin resistant, it becomes type 2 diabetes. Now, type 1 is a whole nother story. It's an autoimmune disease. So
And type one you're born
that is
with,
when the,
right? So this is not something that you can control. They're usually born with type one diabetes, and type two is when you have kind of this progression of insulin resistance, prediabetes, diabetes.
So type 1 can come later on in life. They're not always born with it, but it's an autoimmune disease. So at one point, the immune system is attacking itself and the pancreas is no longer working. So it can no longer provide insulin at all. That's type 1, is that the pancreas no longer produces insulin. And so typically, they're going to have to get synthetic insulin to help their cells open up to get all of the glucose in.
Okay, so one thing that I find really interesting is understanding how broad the symptoms of insulin resistance are, right? Because you would think that it's just because we have somebody in our family that has type 2 diabetes, and so he gets faint, or he might faint when his blood sugar drops, or there's different symptoms for him. But for insulin resistance, it is a litany of diseases that can be caused from this, or at least correlated to this, correct? So I have a list here that I wanted to read. So polycystic ovarian syndrome, type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, obesity, neuropathy, hypertension, heart disease, Alzheimer's. These are all correlated to insulin resistance. Is that correct?
So, and it makes sense if insulin resistance, the problem starts at a cellular level, then it makes sense why there are so many signs and symptoms that come when we are insulin resistant. Because if we have trillions of cells and some of those are insulin resistant, then I mean, it makes sense why we have so many. Because so many times I'll share on my Instagram, like, hey, if you have two or more of these signs or symptoms, you are insulin resistant. And this is what you do, XYZ. And I teach how to reverse insulin resistance. And the amount of comments that I get is like, oh, like what a joke. Like this is going to be like you're talking about like some magic pill or something because one protocol cannot just change everything. And it's like, well, yeah, if you do a few things differently, it can magically get rid of all of those symptoms because you are addressing the problem at a cellular level. When you fix your cells, all those things go away. I mean, Alzheimer's is just going to be insulin resistance of the brain. And like neuropathy is just insulin resistance of the blood vessels. So like all of these things that like, and PCOS is insulin resistance of the ovaries. So it's just that our ovaries have become insulin resistant. So like you're going to start seeing a lot of problems if you don't start addressing this hormone insulin. And it looks like it's a nightmare of things, but it's not so hard to reverse when you start addressing it at a cellular level.
Yeah, and I think that's why education is so important, is that sometimes you just think that it's like they say, a magic pill, but it's not a magic pill. It's learning about it, accepting the knowledge, I think, is probably the hardest part, is to realize that if I make these lifestyle changes, my health will improve. I think some people, when they have poor health and they have a lot of things going on, they think nothing is going to help me get better, right? And so I think sometimes you can kind of create your own barriers to better health, right? And talking about kind of personal health, I'd love for you to talk about your personal story with insulin resistance and also about your mom.
About 2 years ago, my husband actually was kind of starting his own health journey and trying to be a good supportive wife. I was like, okay, I'll do this with you. And he was like, okay, so it's recommended that before we like try doing some different things, some different lifestyle changes over the next 90 days, that we get our blood work done. So I went and got my blood work done, and I was shocked to find out that I was pre-diabetic and insulin resistant. But then once I started looking at all of the symptoms of insulin resistance, it made more sense because I mean, I had inflammation, I had chronic headaches, I like all my knees would hurt, my joints, all of my joints were really swollen to the point where I thought maybe I have arthritis. And that I had, I would get nauseous at night. I couldn't go a long amount of time without food, or I like would become hypoglycemic. There were so many things. I had so many things. I had endometriosis pain, just so many uncomfortable symptoms. So, I mean, I thought this is just a part of aging. I mean, we hear women like kind of say like, as you get older, this just kind of happens and your hormones just kind of get all out of whack. And so to me, I thought like, okay, well, I mean, maybe I go see a doctor about this and about that and get a medication for this or a medication for that. And really grateful to have started this health journey with my husband that helped address insulin resistance. And what was fascinating is, so after 6 months, after addressing my own prediabetes and insulin resistance, my mom got diagnosed with Alzheimer's. That's a devastating diagnosis to hear for your parent, from anybody. Well, I was chatting with a friend who is a metabolic health professional, and she was like, "Hey, did you know that the American Diabetes Association just came out and said that Alzheimer's is now known as type 3 diabetes?" And it was just a couple months earlier that like she like that they had made this statement. And so many people would see that and feel like, "Wait, so it's just insulin resistance of the brain." Okay. Like it wouldn't feel as satisfying to them. But because I had already been on a journey of healing myself from insulin resistance, it gave me hope and made me feel like, wait a minute. Like if this is just insulin resistance of the brain, like I might be able to help my mom. Like that is the biggest relief. I mean, we've never heard of even having any hope of Alzheimer's. It's felt like just like a death diagnosis. And it's like, well, we're near the end. And so that has been fascinating to be helping my mom, and my mom is still like cognitively there to where I've taught her different diet and health hacks of helping her out with different things that she's been able to stick consistent with. And my dad has been so good and supportive of helping her and telling her, hey, did you have fiber before you started eating? And that's been a huge part of her days is, hey, like, how much fiber have you gotten before you eat? And it's been a huge blessing.
A huge blessing. I was really surprised at this whole type 3 diabetes when I was reading, and I mean, I've followed your content for a while, and then I was researching some for this episode, and it blows my mind how this isn't like major headlines of like, Alzheimer's is now being called type 3 diabetes, insulin resistance of the brain, and fiber and low sugar diets, and there's different ways that you can help this. I'm really into medical things. I'm always reading journals and things like that, reading journals and things like that. And I haven't read this until I started following your content and researching for this. It blows my mind. It blows my mind that it's not mainstream because, as you say, it's a devastating disease. 10% of Americans above the age of 65, I think I said, yes, 65 are diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It's devastating.
And what's insane is that kind of as I've been digging deeper into this science, is that truly Alzheimer's, before they walk into the doctor and they get the diagnosis, symptoms have been appearing for the past 20 to 30 years. 2 to 3 decades before somebody's diagnosis. So I think you may have found me on I had a video that went viral where I'm really just crying in this video thinking about my mom's diagnosis. And I just say, like, here's what I wish I could have told my mom 20 years ago. And it's because as like I like reflected on my childhood, like I remember my mom being bedridden from an inflamed back, which seems like so like, oh, that's just a part of aging again. And it's like, no, her body was starting to show signs of insulin resistance a long time ago. My mom has had, I think, 3 different retina surgeries where like they've done like laser treatment, but it's because her eyes were becoming insulin resistant. So it's just like I have become so passionate about this because if you feel like you're on the road to insulin resistance, or you're on that road, or you see your parents who are having some of these signs and symptoms, like it's not just a matter of, hey, accept the aging. And it's like, no, I want to die of old age but still be comfortable. Like I want to be able to go on a walk, and I want to be able to like enjoy my grandkids for a long time. That we don't have to accept these diagnoses of aging and just say, well, that's just a part of life.
Yeah, I do think that we have a lot more control than we think we do of how we can age. But I think that there's a lot of noise and chatter about you need this medication and that medication. And sometimes it comes down to you need more education, not medication, but education about how the body functions and how things work so that you can do what's best for you and your body, you know? I want to go back for a second because you talked about how you got your blood work done and you found out that you were insulin resistant and pre-diabetic. Can you tell us about what your blood work looked like that revealed those diagnoses?
So my A1C was a 6.2. Anything 5.7, greater than 5.7, is considered pre-diabetic. My fasting insulin was a 7.2, which is high. And anything though above a 10 is dangerous. And then what's interesting is that when you get your blood work done, you can actually know how insulin resistant you are with two numbers. And those two numbers are your triglycerides divided by your HDL. So that's just going to be in a normal lipid panel. So if
Yeah, that
you
is a normal
just figure out the
panel.
number, if you just look at your triglycerides and you divide it by your HDL, we preferably want that number to be 1 or less. If it's in between 1 or 2, that's like, hey, we're getting on the road to insulin resistance. two and above is you are insulin resistant. And I was at a 2.48. Today I'm
Wow.
at a 0.96, so less than a one. My fasting insulin went from 7.2 to 4.9, and my A1C went from 6.2 to 4.9 as well. So all of my panels looking much better.
So the proof is literally in the numbers that what you're doing is right for your
Yes.
body.
Yes.
Yeah,
Yes.
absolutely.
Yeah.
So I would love to talk about, so I love that you gave kind of a hack for this because there are a lot of people that don't know the tests that they need to ask to find out if they're insulin resistant or perhaps their doctors say it's not necessary. You don't seem like you have a lot of symptoms. We don't need to order that. So I love that there's kind of a hack that is in a normal lipid profile. In terms of the symptoms, I mean, you said that everybody presents differently when they start with insulin resistance, but could you say that inflammation, maybe just general inflammation in the body, could be a hint?
Yeah, inflammation is definitely correlated. Yeah.
Right. And so that inflammation could look like headaches, like you say, like migraines. I find it quite surprising that the root cause of migraines is intense inflammation. You know, the blood vessels are just really inflamed and they trigger these terrible migraines, but I'm not sure people really understand that there's such a correlation between an inflammatory body and migraines being triggered. So other things you've mentioned have been arthritis, like leg pain. What other types of symptoms do you see in insulin resistant people?
So a lot of times it's in their skin. You can see it in their skin. Acne is a huge sign of insulin resistance, as well as skin tags. If you get a lot of skin tags, a lot of people think I just need to go to my dermatologist, I get them cut off, I get them removed. But if you address insulin resistance, like they really will just fall off, which sounds kind of gross, but like
Yeah,
they
I
fall
know.
off and then they don't come back.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, because
Let's
they're
see.
considered just a benign condition and the dermatologist removes them, but you don't really think about the root cause of a skin tag, right?
There's also like if you have dark patches underneath your armpits or in other like creases, maybe around your neck, that's also a sign of insulin resistance. You'll see sometimes a hump on the back of the neck. Sometimes we think that it's bad posture, but it's actually a sign of insulin resistance. It's interesting because there really are so many signs at every part of the body that you can both see physically and you can feel.
So I know with polycystic ovarian syndrome, I appreciate how you've called it that the ovaries are insulin resistant. A lot of women with polycystic ovarian syndrome have something called PCOS belly, which is where they carry a lot of weight in the midsection. And this can be really triggering and difficult for women to deal with that extra weight in the midsection. You know, I think that the standard of beauty has changed so much over time, but women still feel a lot of shame around kind of belly weight. And that is a real. That makes sense that it would be insulin resistance because insulin resistance also can cause a lot of weight gain in the midsection. Isn't that correct? Just across the
Correct.
board.
What's interesting is that whenever we are insulin resistant, it means that our pancreas is trying to overproduce. Because here's what happens. Remember going back to the cells are locked, they need insulin to open the gate so that glucose can go in. Well, our body, if our cells are not responding to that insulin, our body starts saying, well, wait a minute, let's get the pancreas to create more insulin and see if we can get more keys out there. And if we can get more keys, then maybe it'll start opening, which actually is effective. Like it works. And that's why we prescribe type 2 diabetics insulin. But it makes the problem worse. Because remember, a woman who has now 20 children instead of 10. I mean, she's not going to hear the whimpering of a baby cry. It's only going to get, she's going to become more and more resistant. So our cells will start becoming more and more resistant to that insulin. if we keep on giving it more. But here's what happens when we have too much insulin in the bloodstream. Insulin is a growth hormone. It's trying to help our cells get something, give it the nutrients that it needs. But if we have too much insulin in the bloodstream, it is impossible for our body to burn fat. Because when insulin's in the bloodstream, it's telling the body, hey, we're in storage mode. We're not in, let's go to the fat cells and use our reserves as fuel. No, 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 we've got lots here, clearly, because there's lots of insulin. So we must have lots of glucose here that we need to get rid of. And so the way to start teaching our body to, hey, start tapping into this fat cell and use this fat as fuel is to create opportunities where we have lower amounts of insulin in our blood. And so if we can lower the amount of insulin needed, then our body can start tapping into those fat cells and get rid of that PCOS belly and be able to use that as fuel. Because, I mean, for me, when I've gone to a doctor and I've expressed maybe some like female stuff, I mean, 2 years ago, it was like, hey, you probably should just lose 20 to 25 pounds and then all this stuff should go away. And it's like, well, that's easier said than done. I've counted calories. I've tried that. It's not working. But it's the key is that hormone insulin. And when you can really tap into educating yourself on how to lower the amount of insulin, not only healing happens, but you might feel a little bit more confident getting rid of some of the stubborn fat we've held on to for so long.
So I want to talk to you about some of the methods that you share. Like I said, you have this amazing Instagram account. You share such great information. One of the things that I loved, one of my most favorite kind of aha moments from your content is that you talked about how in nature, there is never any sugar that is not wrapped in fiber, which just really blew my mind when I started thinking about it, because you talk about dates and you talk about everything that is bananas. They all have fiber with them, everything. So I would love for you to talk about, you know, some of the ways that you, you know, you said the doctor would say you need to lose 20, 25 pounds and that you had tried. What made this new approach work for you? And what is that approach?
So, kind of just like I was saying with really addressing insulin is, so every time we have a blood sugar spike, our body has to produce the right amount of insulin to take care of it and move it. So if we eat something that produces a lot of blood sugar in our system, then our body's going to have to produce a lot of insulin in our blood sugars or in our bloodstream, which we don't want to happen. So in order to create less insulin is we have to control the blood sugar. So the best and easiest way to control blood sugar, just like we had said, is starting your meal with fiber. And that is going to be best with non-starchy vegetables. So like, we don't want it to be like a bunch of oatmeal. Oatmeal, like, or like there's some grains that we think of, oh, this is really great fiber. But if you want to control the blood sugar spike, you still want it to be fewer calories. I know I said, like, I tried counting calories. Like, don't get me wrong. Calories are important in terms of that we have an amount of food that our body can metabolize, right? But really, it's what we are doing with our hormones, that hormone insulin, that makes the biggest difference. So if we do non-starchy vegetables, that's a great way to do it. I personally supplement, and it makes it easy because there's no calories. When we eat something that has like vegetables, let's say that we have a bowl of broccoli. A bowl of broccoli is going to be about 30 calories. It's going to have a few grams of fiber, but that fiber is coming from one source. We want to get fiber from multiple sources because fiber is not something that the body metabolizes. We're not eating fiber to give ourselves nutrients. Remember, we only need glucose as nutrients. What fiber does is it has prebiotic fibers, and those are feeding the little guts, the little bacteria in our guts. So there's little bacteria in our guts who need to be fed the right foods. And so that's why we have fiber to feed those little bugs that need a good diet. And if we feed it sugar, I mean, that's where all the inflammation comes and all these things. But if we can feed our gut the right fibers and different sources of fiber, it can become incredible. Dr. Will Boltzowitz, he wrote the book Fiber Fueled. It's such a good book. But he talks about how getting 30 different plants in your diet every week is essential to having a healthy gut. And so that's why I like to supplement, is that it helps me have the variety of different fibers that are essential to regulate blood sugar and feed the healthy gut. So that fiber is your friend. Like God, Mother Nature, whatever you believe in, intended that every carb that you consume is paired with fiber. I mean, you look at rice, we think of it as white rice. Like we think of it like around sushi. That's rice. But that is not what rice looks like in nature. It has like a black exterior, but we remove that fiber because it makes it not taste as good, and it makes it so that it doesn't stay on the shelf at the store as long. And so we remove the fiber, and it's making us sicker. And so we've got to add it back in. Whether that's with non-starchy vegetables or a supplement, you've got to add more fiber in.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've dealt with diet changes over my journey of health issues, and it can be really stressful to change your diet. It can be really stressful to eliminate foods from your diet. So I appreciate supplementing because if it's something like fiber and I appreciate that it can make a big difference in your body, but not be so challenging in that before every meal I have to have a bowl of vegetables. Now, that doesn't mean that the fiber replaces the vegetables, I would assume. It just means that you're helping yourself. I don't believe in these supplements that replace food. I mean, the supplements are additional, to the diet. What is your favorite fiber supplement? I know you mentioned this on your Instagram, but I'd love for you to talk about here just for those listening.
The fiber supplement is called Balance. It's part of a two-part protocol that is paired with intermittent fasting. So in the mornings, some people might want to skip breakfast. There's a lot of people where intermittent fasting is actually not great for. I mean, just to name even a couple is pregnant or nursing. I mean, if a woman is pregnant or nursing, like there's a lot of circumstances where, hey, intermittent fasting might not be the best thing for you to do right now. But one really quick thing on intermittent fasting is that we think of intermittent fasting as we need one really long window of fasting and then a short window of eating. But really, the intermittent fasting that I started with was I had breakfast, I did not snack, I had lunch, I did not snack, and I had dinner. And that is considered intermittent fasting because there are times of your day where you're not eating. Well, so that's where I started with my intermittent fasting journey. And the reason why you want to intermittent fast and why that's so important is because then we're just creating an insulin spike 2 to 3 times a day. Whereas if we're snacking, even if it's just a handful of almonds, every time you eat, you're spiking that insulin. Well, we just want to give it a chance to come back down. So if that's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, or if that's just lunch and dinner, some people even like to throw in just one meal a day, and that's good. Now, I personally suggest that you throw your intermittent fasting schedule around. Don't do the same thing every day. That's really good for your metabolism, as well as I really encourage women to fast with their hormones. And that's like a whole nother thing. But
Is this called seed cycling? Is that what the intermittent fasting with your hormones is?
so I haven't heard seed cycling. Maybe I have learned it from Dr. Mindy Pels. She digs into fasting with your hormones. And on my Instagram, I have like an inspired by Mindy Pels sample calendar that people can get that teaches you how to fast with your hormones.
That's very interesting. So and I love that you said, I'm sorry, I'll just say, because it kind of blows my mind, saying that breakfast, lunch, and dinner is basically fasting, because people do eat all day long. They sit at their office and they eat all day long. And I don't think they realize that it really is messing with kind of the natural cycle of the body of needing to kind of go up and go down and kind of reset, right, before you eat again. Because I think intermittent fasting can be a bit overwhelming to think about not going, and you can get real symptoms when you start intermittent fasting, right? And so I appreciate that kind of walking into it would be just doing three meals with no snacks. I like that idea a lot.
It's important, I think, to start gently, for sure. So one thing, though, is that I talked about one of my symptoms of insulin resistance was that I couldn't go more than like 3 hours in between meals. So even if I'm doing breakfast, lunch, and dinner, that means you're typically going to need about 4 hours in between those meals. So now I skip breakfast. Like I only eat breakfast the week before my cycle is when I have three meals a day. Every other day, it's 1 to 2 meals a day. But to make that easier, the protocol that I do, so one part is fiber, adding fiber before my meals. And the other part is a form of a concentrated version of yerba mate. So yerba mate is like an Argentinian drink. They love it. They've been using it for years. Well, a problem with yerba mate, though, is that there are a lot of carcinogens in it because of the way that it's roasted over the fiber, over the fire. And the yerba mate that I drink has gone through a process where it removes all of the impurities, all of the toxins, all of the carcinogens, and it has all of the good and takes out, removes all of the bad of it. And what that does is it will actually helps naturally lower your insulin levels. So it helps with that. It also takes away the food noise. There's a lot of medications out there right now that people are really hyped up about because it's helping them with weight loss, and it addresses a hormone called GLP-1. Well, this yerba mate, it addresses GLP-1 naturally. So it encourages your body to produce, I think it's by 64%. It increases it by 64% of your own GLP-1. So you're not synthetically injecting this hormone. Instead, it's teaching your body, hey, okay, it's time to produce more. And so then it makes you feel fuller, and you're not, you just don't have like that food noise, and it suppresses your appetite a little bit. So it makes that intermittent fasting feel really easy, really. And so those two, the fiber and the yerba mate, and as well paired with intermittent fasting, is what I've done to really address my insulin resistance. I personally did not change my diet because that felt overwhelming to me. And I just felt like I just needed to consistently do small things. And then it slowly improved. Okay, we're going to add more protein. Okay, we're going to like make sure that I'm getting enough water every day, stay hydrated, and so on. But that protocol is what helped me like really get my health journey going, because it was easy. It was doable. I didn't have to change the way I was eating. I had to change the times that I was eating and add in 2 supplements, and that's it.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I like that, and I really appreciate that, because having, like I said, diet changes and elimination diets and things like that, it's very stressful, and your body responds to that stress, not only because you're changing your diet and you're changing the nutrients and the vitamins that you're receiving, but then your body's just stressed. You know, it wants to have the pizza or the gluten or something like that. I will mention that the yerba mate is really big here in Europe. There are a lot of people here in Spain that drink it, and it's a tea, it's a dry leaf tea, where they take these really small pieces of the tea that's been smoked, as you said, or roasted. And they put it in a cup, they put in a cup and they add hot water, and there's a special straw that they drink it from. And this straw prevents the leaves from coming up the straw. And you see people in the streets. It's such a thing here. So I was surprised when I found out that it was kind of a natural substitute to the GLP-1 drugs, because I had no idea.
Yeah. And one thing that's funny is that my husband and I have tried a few other yerba mates. Just, we have a local Latino market in our town here. And we were like, hey, we were actually out of our yerba mate, and we're like, let's just go try that one. And I was like, yeah, this tastes like the bottom of a barn. Like, if you were to like scoop up the bottom of a barn and put it, yeah. But people love it. Now this one, there's a lemon flavor and a lemon ginger flavor, and it tastes nothing like the normal yerba mate. So it tastes very different, but it has the same effects. But yeah, I know people love the traditional yerba mate. Love it. It's great because of the health benefits. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's like, you know, Vegemite in Australia. You know, people grow up eating it and they love it. Yeah. And then an adult somewhere else in the world tries it and they're like, people actually eat this? It's terrible. It's
terrible.
So
yeah.
I feel like it could be similar to that for sure. I want to talk about, we're getting into the holidays. We just passed Thanksgiving. Now we're getting into kind of all the Christmas parties and Christmas dinner and things like that. And so I kind of want to talk about what advice you would give women going into the holiday season, thinking about, you know, insulin resistance, these types of symptoms that they could be dealing with, and just kind of the stress of the holidays, the fact that there's a lot more food, a lot more alcohol, a lot more sugar. What do you suggest for these women?
Yeah, so one of my favorite things about what I've done to address my insulin resistance is that I haven't had to say no to my most favorite things. So if somebody is bringing me a holiday treat, I might not say no to it. I might say no to it and I don't want it, but that's it's available to me. And I think that that's really important during the holidays. We often think, you know what, I'm just going to wait to address my health starting in January. But when it comes to addressing insulin resistance, there's no better time than today. Today is the best day to start addressing insulin resistance because it's just some simple hacks. Like I love to say, it's about delay, don't deny. So if somebody comes and brings you a holiday treat, it's not that you can't have it, just save it. Save it until you are in your eating window, if it's after your dinner or something. After dinner is going to be the best time to consume a treat because you've had a day, hopefully, full of good nutrients, good fiber, good protein, some healthy fats. So it's not going to have as crazy of an insulin spike as maybe it would on an empty stomach. So we don't want to start our day eating the leftover holiday treats. Like that's just the worst breakfast you can have. So don't deny yourselves of those treats. Just save them until later in the day after you've had some good healthy fats, fiber, and protein. And so that is a huge part. But then also, I double up on my fiber. When I am going to a holiday party, instead of the old Denise that maybe would have like, hey, this is a holiday, I'm just going wild. Now I do two of my doses of balance of the supplement, the fiber supplement, and I'm not eating as much. I'm not digging in quite as deep to the holiday meals. I'm able to eat until satisfied, which I couldn't do before then. Which, P.S., one of the biggest signs and symptoms of insulin resistance is constant hunger and constant cravings. And if you can start addressing those, you're going to feel in control, especially throughout the holidays. That's really important. That's when people feel the most hopeless, is feeling like, okay, you're telling me what to eat. You're telling me how to address insulin resistance, but you don't understand how little control I feel over my nutrition. And so really small, simple changes of intermittent fasting, starting your meals with fiber, huge. And the yerba mate is magical.
Yeah, fiber helps you feel more satiated, correct? It makes you feel more full.
Correct. Yep.
Right.
Yeah, it's going to fill up your stomach. Like, it's kind of fun. The fiber supplement that I use, sometimes I'll do like a little visual. If you go onto my Instagram, I've got a few videos where I share it, where you shake it up and then you can like see that it turns into like a slime, which is kind of cool because when you think about it, that's what's happening in our gut and in our stomachs, which is important because it's encapsulating the carbs. So the fiber that we've removed from these carbs, now it's going back over and it's coating them and encapsulating with the fiber that we've removed through processing all of our foods.
And I imagine that this is going to help a lot with gut health. And, one of my previous episodes, I spoke with Katie Tarr, who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. We were talking about autoimmune disease in women. And she said, anybody that I talk to, I want to know how they're pooping because I want to know what's going on in their GI tract. And fiber is going to really help with that. All these people that kind of go back and forth on the spectrum of diarrhea and constipation and all these things, one of the main things is just get more fiber in your diet. Your stomach will feel better. It will move and clear all those toxins because that's what happens when you poop, is you're getting everything out of your body that it doesn't need, right? So I do know that
Gut
that
health
is
and
sorry, go ahead.
gut health and insulin resistance are very connected to each other. Many people who have IBS and other gut issues have seen wonders by just addressing insulin resistance.
Right. And I liked recently you talked about kind of this vicious cycle of carb cravings and sugar cravings. And, I do think that people feel like, but you don't know how bad I have it, right? And I think that, sugar is very addicting and it can be very difficult to come off of sugar. I like that you have this approach of kind of easing into things. But you also said recently, which I appreciated, was sometimes you have to get uncomfortable and you have to realize that going through this process, you're going to be uncomfortable, but it's where you're going that is what matters the most.
If you're wanting to make any change, I mean, even with supplements that can make it easier, there's still going to be some discomfort. I mean, especially if you have an unhealthy gut and you're adding fiber, it's not going to feel comfortable at first. But you have to be willing to endure that discomfort, irregardless of what path you choose when taking control of your health. If you're willing to be just a little bit uncomfortable, you'll have a new life on the other side.
Right. And I also want to mention that, I find it very intelligent that you and your husband decided to get a blood panel done before you started making significant changes in your diet and your lifestyle. I think that's so smart. And last week I did an episode with Brittany Marsden about PMDD, and she says the one thing that she tells her female clients is get your blood work done and do it annually so you can see what's changing in your body. So, how lucky to have gotten that blood test done then. So now you can see how much your body has changed, right? Or you were able to see what you were diagnosed with, but also now you can kind of track these changes and you know you're on the right track.
Even more so if you're wanting a weight loss journey, I would definitely recommend getting blood work done because so many times you're going to feel like a failure if the scale isn't moving. But if your blood work is moving in the right direction, then you know you're on the right track because you have to heal from inside before you're going to start seeing major differences outside.
Right. And I mean, at the end of the day, extra weight on the body, there's a reason for it, right? The body is not in balance, that it's not burning enough calories, it's, not burning enough fat. And so I think that when the goal is weight loss, it gets kind of confusing as to, what you're really doing for your body, when actually the goal is to have a body that functions more optimally so that you can lose weight, right?
I always tell people anytime they want to address insulin resistance and they're complaining about their stubborn belly fat, I always say, like, hey, weight loss is a side effect of addressing metabolic health. So, like, if you address it, that will just come. But you have to be careful why you are wanting to lose weight. When you really go about it, of I want to heal my body from the inside out, it's a world of difference. You treat your body and your mind differently. You talk to yourself differently.
Yeah. And I think that is such an, I'm so happy you said that, because the mind-body connection, and I think especially for females, is so important. The way we talk to ourselves, the way that we address our bodies and that we treat our bodies, just by how we think about our bodies. You know, I remember growing up and there would be quizzes in magazines, and they would say, like, what part of your body do you hate the most? And it's like, maybe ask me what part of the body I mm-hmm. love the most. But it was always, you know, mm-hmm. like so easy to fill in five different things of which you hated the most about your body. I just think women are kind of ingrained to be critical of their bodies. And, you know, I really believe that the way that you treat yourself, the way that you feel about yourself, reflects in how you treat yourself, right? And so, mm-hmm. you know, the more self-love that you can kind of foster, you know, I think that you, the more you love yourself, the more you take care of it.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I love that.
Yeah. We are getting to the end. It's gone really fast. I can't believe how quickly this has passed by. Yeah. And I want to ask just kind of some final thoughts, anything that you would want to add that maybe you'd like to say in closing?
No, just thanks for having me here. This was really fun. Like, it's so fun to be able to chat with somebody about this. Usually it's me just talking to a screen and posting a video. So a conversation like this is way more fun. And just thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's been such a pleasure and honor to talk to you about it. And I thank you so much for your content, for what you're sharing. You have educated me so much about this theme, and that's really why I wanted to chat with you here to kind of share this even more. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the Hairy Chin Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, head over to www.thehairychin.com to join our village and stay in the know. I'm Spencer Moore, reminding you that knowledge isn't just powerful, it's empowering. When you know better, you do better. So stay strong, keep going, and I'll see you next time.